Changing Channels, an anthology of supernatural crossover fic, written and read by Baylor, rated PG. Outside, a crossover with S.E. Hinton's novel, The Outsiders, pre-series. Ponyboy knew that everyone thought it was soda, that it had been the last straw, and that he was just broken now, in some fundamental way that couldn't be fixed. Well, he knew that's what Derry thought, at least, and Derry was the only person whose opinion mattered in the least to Ponyboy anymore. But it wasn't soda. Well, at least not directly. His brother being drafted and then dying in some godforsaken country halfway around the world had certainly lessened Ponyboy's interest in college and making something of himself. But it wasn't like he'd had anything else to do, and he didn't return to school after the funeral, formulating plans to bail out on everything and everyone. Strangely enough, it had been Steve Randall, who had returned from that same draft and that same godforsaken country, alive but destroyed. Ponyboy had never liked Steve, but he'd been Soda's best friend, and they'd grown up together, and somehow he and Derry kept finding themselves looking out for Steve, sobering Steve up, bailing Steve out, trying to find him some kind of help. Some part of Ponyboy disliked Steve even more than usual, because he'd been with Soda. He'd shared a whole part of Soda's life that was lost to his brothers. But despite that, no one deserved whatever had happened to wreck Steve like this. Sometimes, when Steve's hands were shaking and his eyes were wide and bloodshot, he would grab hold of Ponyboy's shirt front and tell him that they'd come home with him, some of those other poor kids who'd been sent a world away to die, that they followed him around and wouldn't leave him alone. Ponyboy found that easy to believe. He saw Soda everywhere he looked, every day. "Can you see them, Ponyboy?" Steve would rasp. "It would be you, if anyone could. Soda always said it was you. You were the one." "Yeah, I see him too," Ponyboy would say, and then put Steve to bed and do his dishes and stock up his fridge, and then let Derry know he was set for now before heading back to school. Over Christmas break, though, crashing on Steve's couch, he started to think Steve meant something else. Either that, or lunacy was catching, because Ponyboy woke up one night to see a lanky guy in fatigues, dog tags, and a cowboy hat sitting in the armchair, watching him sleep. The guy tipped his hat to Ponyboy and disappeared. He thought it was a dream until two nights later, he turned around from the fridge and a squat Italian-looking guy with a broken nose was playing solitaire at the table. He acknowledged Ponyboy with a flick of his eyes before fading away. "Tex and JT," Steve said, when he was sober and Ponyboy had worked up the courage to ask him who, exactly, he kept seeing. "Lost them with Soda, but I never see him." Steve went into the bedroom and dug around in the top drawer, coming back out with two sets of dog tags. "Four of us, pinned down, and I make it out without a scratch. How's that happen, huh? How's that make sense?" He sat on the couch, staring at the tags, running his thumb over them like good luck charms. "I don't know," Ponyboy said, because it made no sense. It was horrifically insensible, and if he thought too much about it, he would end up like Steve. He reached out and took the tags from Steve's hands, because he couldn't stand to see him finger them anymore. "Supposed to take them to their family," Steve said hollowly. "Can't make myself go see them, not when I'm still here and they're still back there. They're never going home. None of us are." On New Year's Day, feeling overcrowded in the tiny apartment with Steve and the ghost, Ponyboy made Steve put his coat on and took his car keys and drove them to Texas. Tex's mother served them strong, scalding coffee and wept over the tags. Steve averted his eyes and called her ma'am. Ponyboy drank the wretched coffee, kept his head down, and drove Steve home. New Jersey was way too far to drive, so he made Steve write to JT's folks, then put the letter and the tags in an envelope. They walked to the post office together in silence, and then back at the apartment, Ponyboy let Steve drink his way through a whole bottle of Johnny Walker, and then covered him up with a blanket and left him to sleep it off. He never saw the ghosts again. Back at school, there was an urban legend about a girl who hung herself off the rail of the fourth-floor stairwell in Weyburn Hall. Co-eds refused to take those stairs at night, taking the long way around the building to the south stairs instead. Rumor went, in the right moonlight, you could still see the body, swinging by its rope. The stairwell was always cold, but that could have been a draft, or poor insulation, or any number of things. Ponyboy lingered until closing on several nights, and all he saw was the janitor. "What's your deal?" asked his study partner, Linda. "It's just a stupid story. I wouldn't have told you about it if I'd known you were going to start lurking in stairwells." Ponyboy shrugged. "Just want to know if it's real, I guess," he said lamely. But the truth was, he kept thinking about Tex and JT, and Steve saying that Soda knew it was him, that he was the one. It was easier than he thought it would be to hide in the classroom until the janitor locked up. He brought a flashlight, his history book, and a thermos of coffee, and all that happened until about 1 a.m. was that he got a lot of reading done. It wasn't until he stood to stretch and crack his neck that the movement caught his eye. Back and forth. Back and forth. Her tongue lolled out of her mouth. Her eyes bulged. Her feet kicked. After shimmying out a window at Weyburn Hall, Ponyboy had to shimmy into one at his dorm, because it was way past hours and no way was he explaining to anyone where he'd been. There was nothing worthwhile about ghosts in the school library. It all just had to do with stories, tales, yarns. There wasn't anything practical, like how to get rid of one. "Sweetie, you know this ain't real, right?" said Clarice the palm reader in her husky cigarette voice. She waved a bright red fingernail around to indicate her tiny room of gauzy tapestries and muted lights. "You want someone real. You ain't gonna find it in the phone book. You tried just asking the ghost to leave?"
She's kind of hanging," Ponyboy said. "I don't think she's a talking-to ghost."
Clarice lit a cigarette and studied him. "You seen some others?" Ponyboy nodded. "You get rid of them?" Ponyboy cleared his throat. "They needed something done," he said. Clarice nodded. "And this one? Offed herself? Creeping everyone out?" At Ponyboy's confirmation, she drummed her fingers on the table and hummed to herself before crushing out her cigarette. She gave him a name and address. Ponyboy was a little shocked when he realized it was in the colored part of town. He was also surprised by how nice the little houses were. It looked a sight better than his old neighborhood. "White trash," a memory echoed in his head, and he shivered. A teenage girl answered the door and then yelled, "Gamma!" when he said that Clarice had sent him. Gamma had no teeth and used a cane, but her eyes were sharp. She didn't invite Ponyboy in, but she did ask him to sit in one of the porch chairs with her. To his surprise, he found himself telling her everything, Soda and Steve and the dog tags, and now the hanging girl, and how Soda said he would be the one. He'd be the one to know, and he couldn't explain why, but it was important that he put this ghost to rest. "Well, child," Gamma said when he had finished, "you dig up that body, and you salt and burn those bones, and that girl won't bother no one no more." "What?" Ponyboy said, feeling as if she'd asked him to sacrifice a puppy on a tombstone at midnight. "You ain't willing to do that, then it ain't so important to you as you think," Gamma said. "Girl ain't hurting no one but herself, so it's up to you what to do." Then she sat back in her chair, conversation over. Ponyboy wiped his sweaty hands on his jeans and stood. "Thank you, ma'am," he said, and went down the steps. "Boy," Gamma called, and he turned around. She was leaning forward again. "Salt is mighty pure, mighty powerful. You find yourself in need of protection." He nodded. "Thank you, ma'am," he said again, and left. The old house was too crowded, even though Judy was just starting to show, but it was Derry's house now, and Ponyboy couldn't settle in there, so he found a farmhand job up in Nebraska for the summer break. Working outside in the cool Nebraska air, the blue sky and sun above him, there were worse ways to spend the summer, he thought. The other hands were coarse and called him college boy, but they liked him, could smell the childhood poverty on him, knew he was closer to their breed than most college students. He'd always liked the country, wanted to spend more time there, and sometimes when he woke in the bunkhouse, he thought the rafters overhead belonged to an old church, long burned down. Old farmhands liked to talk, like old women. They were also superstitious, like old women. When the Van Ansel boy went missing, they muttered that the child's parents should have kept him from playing in that Massey Lane underpass, that it was evil, wouldn't nothing grow around it, was something lurking under there. Luke, the other young summer hand, laughed at them, said they were scared of trolls under bridges, but Ponyboy didn't say anything. He watched them carry the Van Ansel boy from the river a few days later, watched his mother wailing and reaching for her child, watched his father fall to the ground. It was cold under Massey Lane. No living thing grew or lived there. Ponyboy felt like an idiot, clutching the salt shaker he'd lifted at dinner. The hand on his shoulder was heavy, and he tossed the salt right into the malicious, grinning face before running at top speed back to the bunkhouse. He spent his next afternoon off at the local library. Andrew Massey had no children of his own, but he took in orphaned or abandoned boys to help on his farm. When he died in 1896, the church refused to bury him in its graveyard. The old records didn't say why, but they did say that the minister and the gravedigger were the only people in attendance at his funeral at the old farmstead. If Ponyboy had felt like an idiot with his salt shaker, he felt like a deranged criminal with his shovel. He dumped real salt on the body, intended for the winter salt licks, once he'd bashed through the simple, half-rotted pine box, and then squirted charcoal fuel on it. As he watched the body burn, he wondered if he'd lost his mind. No more children went missing from Massey Lane that summer. Ponyboy only went back to school once, to track down a name and address. He had to break into the registrar's office in the middle of the night, but once he had a hometown, he was able to go through old obituaries. It didn't feel as crazy this time, digging up the body in the dead of night. Or did it feel crazier? Ponyboy wasn't sure. Deary blew a gasket. He had every right, Ponyboy figured. Ponyboy was all set up with a free ride to school, a way to make something of himself, while Deary worked his way through night school and tried to support his little family. All he needed was his kid brother messing everything up, causing him headaches, throwing away his future. Ponyboy used the money he'd made at the ranch to buy a beat-up old truck. He started by looking for lost kids. He found some more bodies to dig up and burn. He also found that not all monsters are already corpses. He did odd jobs for money, slept in the cab when it was warm enough, ate in greasy diners. He liked the smell of the road, the low rasp of truckers' voices, the kind faces of diner waitresses. He liked the stories old folks had to tell, whether they led to a real hunt or not. He felt, for the first time, like he was living his own life, like he was doing something that mattered to someone other than Derry. Maybe he was crazy, but crazy seemed to be suiting him just fine for now. He went home to visit at Christmas. Steve had lost the apartment and was living with some woman who didn't welcome visitors, so he crashed on Derry's couch. The baby was cute, and Judy seemed glad to have him, even if Derry was clearly bottling up a whole lot of things he had to say. When it felt too tense, he walked down to the old empty lot, lie down and look at the stars like he and Johnny had done so many evenings. For the first time, it didn't make him sad. Two-Bit showed up one night, fresh from jail for fighting or drinking or speeding, or probably all three. "Boy howdy, Pony Boy," he yelled across the lot. "I'd have come by the house, except I think your big brother might have bashed my head in for delinquitizing his baby." Ponyboy sat up on his elbows and grinned at Two-Bit. "Nah," he said easily. "You should come by and see him. Looks like Derry." Two-Bit flopped down beside him. "Mr. Responsibility and his all-American family," he said, but there was no bitterness in his voice. "Guess he'll be selling the house and moving along before too long." Ponyboy didn't answer, because it was true, and while he was glad for Derry, he was a little sad, because then all of this would be gone for him, forever. Two-Bit was peering into his face keenly, and Ponyboy could smell the liquor on his breath. "I'd call you college boy or something, but I guess you ain't anymore," he said. "Nope," Ponyboy answered, and Two-Bit nodded. "Derry and Judy think you're one of those hippies now, spreading free love or some such," Two-Bit said, and Ponyboy shrugged. "You still seem like a greaser to me," Two-Bit concluded. "No flowers painted on your face, no funky clothes." They both laughed, because of all the things Ponyboy might become in his life, hippie wasn't one of them. When they had stopped and were lying side by side, watching the darkening sky, Two-Bit said, "Now, Steve,
Steve says you're hunting ghosts. Ponyboy's breath caught in his chest.
Almost as crazy as me being a hippie, he finally said.
That's what I said, Two-Bit answered. Although I reckon the world might need some ghost hunters. Can't figure out the use of hippies.
Two-Bit stood and looked down at Ponyboy.
You like it? He asked, curiously.
Ponyboy nodded.
You happy?
Ponyboy nodded again, because yeah, he was happy.
You crazy?
Ponyboy shrugged.
All right then, Two-Bit said, and shoved his hands in his pockets. I'll be seeing you, kid.
Not if I see you first, Ponyboy called after him, and Two-Bit laughed without turning around.
Motorists kept turning up dead along the same stretch of highway in Missouri, but nights of camping out in the truck along it proved fruitless, so Ponyboy started scouring the nearby countryside. That was when he almost stumbled over the bodiless head and fell on his ass screaming like a girl. He kept screaming when someone grabbed him from behind and put a large, long, sharp knife to his throat.
Shut up and show me your teeth, a man's voice said, and Ponyboy was astounded enough that he stopped screaming.
What? He started, but then a hand grabbed his face and pulled up his lips and prodded along his teeth. The knife disappeared and the body behind him let go.
What are you doing out here, kid? The voice asked.
Walking, Ponyboy gasped. I ran out of gas and I was looking for a phone and...
Bullshit, the voice said, and the tip of the knife prodded Ponyboy's back.
People kept disappearing out here, Ponyboy said. I just want to help.
When there was no answer and the knife didn't go through him, he got bold and asked, What are you doing out here?
Hunting vampires, the voice said, and kicked over the head on the ground. It turned toward Ponyboy to reveal gleaming, lethal teeth.
The man's name was Daniel Elkins, and he said he was a hunter. Ghosts, werewolves, demons, monsters, but above all, vampires. Ponyboy would have thought he was crazy, but for the vampire head in the woods. Apparently, wooden stakes didn't work. Vampires had to be decapitated.
Ponyboy said he was a hunter, too. And Elkins laughed.
Fledgling, Elkins said, and then asked what Ponyboy had hunted.
Not bad, he said thoughtfully once Ponyboy had finished, then added, for a fledgling.
2 nights later, Ponyboy helped Elkins clean out the nest. They went back to Elkins' campsite covered in blood and gore and got very, very drunk.
Elkins said that Ponyboy needed some real weapons.
Elkins said that Ponyboy needed to know about rituals and wards and protection.
Elkins said that Ponyboy needed to know what to look for.
Elkins said Ponyboy needed to pull his head out of his ass before he got himself killed.
You gonna help me with that? Ponyboy asked, and it turned out that Elkins would.
The woman kicked Steve out, and the Curtis brothers lost track of him. Two-Bit went back to jail for fighting and drinking and speeding. He also married a bleach blonde named Donna, and they filled up a single wide with scabby little red-headed kids, except for one, who was born with dark skin and an afro while Two-Bit was doing a 2-year stint for bootlegging, but who still called him Daddy. None of these happenings seemed to affect their happiness or their ability to produce more scabby little kids, and their door was always open to Ponyboy. Derry finished school and sold the house. Ponyboy went back one last time, after Derry and Judy were already gone, climbing in through the bedroom window that had never closed right. The house looked small or empty, which seemed wrong to Ponyboy. He lay on the living room floor all night, hearing the front door bang and smelling chocolate cake. He aged, to his own surprise, but found he didn't mind much. He still liked the smell of the road and diner coffee. The truck ran aground, and he worked steady for a while until he could get a new one. He rescued a little beagle pup from a Wendigo lair and named her Scarlet. She loved to ride with her head out the window, smelling adventure and the road and the hunt. He ran into other hunters and had beers with them. He heard about other hunters who had gone off to the last hunt. It was a dangerous business, after all, and someday soon Ponyboy would be an old-timer in this business. He met an occasional fledgling himself and told them to pull their heads out of their asses before they got themselves killed. Winchester wasn't really a fledgling, more of a late bloomer, but his head sure was up his ass,
because his two kids were in the back seat of his sweet 1967 Impala. Ponyboy told him that he needed to remove it before he got his kids killed, but Winchester shook his head. "The thing that killed my wife, you see, it was in Sammy's nursery," Winchester said. He still had that fledgling manner of looking down a lot, not certain that he wasn't crazy. Ponyboy glanced in the back seat, where the younger boy was valiantly trying to get out of his car seat to get to Scarlett, who was clambering over both boys with excitement and yipping her delight. She liked kids. "I'm real sorry, John," Ponyboy said. "I lost my folks. I know it's rough on your boys. But you ought to leave them with someone you're going to take to the hunt." Winchester shook his head. "No," he said, "you don't understand. She was over Sammy's crib. It was in his room." It was over his crib, Winchester didn't say, but Ponyboy looked at the wild-haired toddler, now triumphantly free of his constraints, laughing and petting Scarlett. "It's my family," Winchester was saying. "I'm just trying to save my family. Splitting us up, we'd be so vulnerable." Ponyboy nodded and looked away from the little boys. "Scarlett," he called, and whistled, and the little dog jumped out of the car and came running over to the two men. "Good luck to you, John," he said, and shook his hand. Jerry lived in a yellow ranch house, and if kids still used the old labels, his kids would have been called Socias. Ponyboy didn't care much. The kids were happy and healthy and loved playing with Scarlett and riding around in his beat-up old truck. He'd take them out for an ice cream, and they'd fight about who got to sit next to him in the cab. There were Curtis boys again, and a Curtis girl, and that was a good thing. Judy, who was good and sensible and gracious, always made him feel at home, and had eventually stopped looking at him with pity. Things were what they were. Ponyboy couldn't tell what Jerry looked at him with anymore. It had been years since he'd been able to read his brother, if he'd ever been able to. Still, it was enough to sit on the steps of his back porch and share a beer, watching his kids running and screaming in the yard, Scarlett yipping and running with them. Maybe he was broken, Ponyboy thought, but then maybe everybody was. It wasn't such a bad life, either way.
But can it be when we can see so vividly a memory? And yes, you say so must the day to fade away. Yet filled with sorrow and compassion, though not imagined, all things that happen will age to old, though gold, 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 gold. Thank you.
An American Werewolf in New York City, a crossover with Without a Trace, set after 219 Folsom Prison Blues, but before 312 Juice and Bello. It was so early in the morning that it might still accurately be called night, and Agent Danny Taylor was swigging coffee and leaning against the car, unmindful of the eddying red lights illuminating the scene. This was his least favorite way to start a day, and his least favorite way to end a case. Instead of reporting back to Mrs. Hassan that her husband had turned up in a hospital, or jail cell, or motel room, he was going to have to tell her that her husband had turned up in an alley, dead. The coroner's guys were finally taking the body bag away. Martin finished talking with the techies and headed toward him. "How do you die of an animal attack in New York City?" Martin asked. Danny slurped his coffee and shrugged. He'd been contemplating that very question for the past 2 hours and had yet to come up with a good answer. Martin's phone went off and he flipped it open. "Yeah," he said. Then, "All right, well, it was worth a shot. Thanks for checking." He snapped the phone shut. "All big cats and canines accounted for at the zoos," he told Danny. "Hmm," Danny said, and drained his cup. He pitched it into a trash can. "Leaves dog or escaped illegal exotic animal." "ME said no way was that a dog," Martin answered, shaking his head. "Wolf, at least." Danny shrugged. He'd seen some pretty big dogs in his day, bigger than any wolf. Personally, he was leaning toward a pet tiger or something on the loose. With any luck, the thing would have mauled its owner before hitting the streets. Some people just didn't understand that there was a reason they were called wild animals. It was so late in the day that it might now accurately be called night, and Danny was again swigging coffee and leaning against the car, because a street cop had uncovered another body, this one so badly mauled that they couldn't tell if it was male or female, and probably 2 nights old. That made 2 kills in 2 nights. Sometimes Danny just didn't like his job. Martin headed toward him, shaking his head. "They're going to try to pull prints down at the lab," he said. He reached out and took Danny's cup out of his hand, tossing back what was left inside. "We gotta find this thing." "Animal control?" Danny asked, and Martin nodded at a man and a woman in blue jumpsuit uniforms talking to the techies. "They're talking about calling in a specialist from U.S. Wildlife. Can you believe it?" he said. "We're in the Bronx." "This used to be farmland," Danny said. "This was a trip to the country." "Yeah," Martin said. "People get mauled to death by lots of cows and chickens back then." He went around the car and got in the passenger side, slamming the door. Danny guessed he was ready to go. NYPD and U.S. Wildlife took over the case, and Danny was coming off a frantic 3-day search for a missing 5-year-old, now safely in her mother's arms, when Martin passed him in the hallway, keys in hand, grabbed him by the arm, and pulled him into the elevator. The victim was a homeless guy, ground up under an overpass, and there was a witness. Unfortunately, the witness went by the name of Clyde Frog and had reached that point of alcoholism where you were never actively drunk, just permanently pickled. "It was a wolf," Clyde Frog told them earnestly. "But it was a man. It was a wolf man." "What? Like Team Wolf?" Danny asked, and Clyde Frog stared at him blankly. "Like a man who's a wolf," Clyde Frog repeated. "Thank you, Mr. Frog," Martin said, closing his notebook. "We appreciate your time." They gave Clyde Frog a cup of hot coffee and a still good sandwich that was in the back of the car and left the mangled body in the hands of the NYPD. Danny let Martin drive and leaned against the smooth, cool glass of the passenger window. "Think it's the same thing that killed Hassan?" Martin asked, and Danny was too tired to shrug. "It's been a month," he said, and let his eyes close. "Probably not. Wild dogs, other bums, crazy hopped-up kids in werewolf masks. Not our case, anyway." "Yeah." Martin was quiet,
and Danny was in a near doze when his partner hesitantly said, "Maybe it really is." "Martin," Danny said, opening his eyes and putting warning in his voice. "Shut up." "All right, all right," Martin grumbled, "and shut up about it." When Danny walked out of his front door the next morning, Martin was parked at the curb. His saving grace was that he had coffee in the car waiting for Danny. The victim was a college student, coming home from a late-night shift at the corner diner. He'd been dragged behind a building, and Danny had to admit, it looked like something had enjoyed him as a late supper. He let Martin poke around and ask questions while Danny looked at the brick wall behind the body. It was taller than him, quite a jump for a canine. There was a large, muddy paw print on it, big as Danny's hand. "Hey, Danny," Martin called, and he meandered over to where Martin was talking to a couple of suits, detectives probably. "This is Agent Scott and Agent Johnson from U.S. Wildlife," Martin said, gesturing to the two men. "My partner, Agent Danny Taylor." Danny nodded cordially and shook the men's hands. "Scott and Johnson," he said, "like the AC/DC lead singers." "Dude, classic rock fan," said the shorter one, Scott, then looked abashed when his partner shot him a look. "No one ever gets it. Cracks me up." "So, what does U.S. Wildlife think?" Danny asked. "Escaped tiger? Wild dogs?" "Wild dogs, maybe," Johnson said. "Wolf, more likely." "People traffic those?" Martin asked. "Sometimes," Johnson said. "Some people like to breed them with dogs. All illegal, of course. We'll find it." "Soon, I hope," Danny said. "It's got a taste for man flesh." Scott shrugged. "We're in the city, man. Not much else for it to eat," he pointed out, and Danny nodded. He jerked a thumb at Martin. "Agent Fitzgerald thinks it's a werewolf," he said, deadpan, and Martin shot him a dirty look. "We had a witness who said it was a wolf man," Martin said carefully. Scott took out his notepad and flipped through it. "Which one was that?" "The homeless guy," Martin said. Scott made a note. "Remember the witness's name?" he asked. Martin flushed. "Ah," he said, and Danny supplied, "Clyde Frog." Scott and Johnson looked at them, eyebrows raised in identical skepticism. Scott shut his notebook. Johnson looked to Martin. "It's not a werewolf, Agent Fitzgerald," he said firmly, and Martin turned bright red. "Obviously," Martin said. "Obviously," Johnson repeated, then shifted his gaze to include both of them. "We'll let you know when we wrap this up so that you can close your file." "Thanks," Danny said. On the way to the office, Danny said, "Are you thinking it's a man who becomes a wolf, or a half-wolf, half-man?" "I hate you," Martin said, and Danny laughed. "I know," he said. They ran into Vivian in the elevator. "Another dine and dash?" she asked. "U.S. Wildlife has it," Martin said. Behind him, Danny mouthed werewolf to Vivian, then stretched his face into a ferocious visage. He held up clawed hands and waved them menacingly at the back of Martin's head. "Good," Vivian said. "Hope they close it fast." She got off the elevator 3 floors before them. The doors closed behind her. Danny pawed the air some more. "I can see you," Martin said. His face, reflected in the shiny doors, was tight with frustration. Danny growled and slobbered. U.S. Wildlife never sent them a final report, but the next month was mangled bodiless. It wasn't in Danny's nature to question why corpses weren't turning up. It was paperwork day, and he and Martin had commandeered the conference room and covered the table in files, coffee cups, and sandwich wrappers. Danny was so engrossed in the fascinating minutiae of the FBI coding system that he didn't even bother looking up when the door opened. Someone slapped a file down in front of him. "Agents Taylor and Fitzgerald?" someone demanded, and Danny looked up to see a very pissed-off-looking black man in a nice suit in front of him. A bored-looking white guy in a decidedly cheaper suit lingered near the door. "Yeah," Danny said. The man pointed at the file. "Are you the geniuses who talked to these two guys?" Danny looked at the file. Clipped to it were 2 photographs. "Agents Scott and Johnson," Martin supplied, standing up to lean over the table and take a look. "From U.S. Wildlife. They were tracking some kind of loose wild animal." Danny noticed that Agents Scott and Johnson were in mugshots.
Ah, he said. That's right, the black man yelled. Ah, let me ask you something, Agents Taylor and Fitzgerald. You two ever bothered to take a look at our own freaking most wanted list?
Yeah, Danny said slowly. He had a feeling that this was going to result in a lot of paperwork. He also had a feeling that he and Martin were going to have to do that paperwork standing up after Jack got through with them.
Martin was unloading the file box from the back seat when Danny said his name. He twisted in his seat to look at his partner.
It could have been a werewolf, he said, and put on his I'm not making fun of you face.
You heard Agent Hendrickson, Martin said. These guys are kooks. They run around killing people because they think they're werewolves or demons or witches or whatever.
Yeah, Danny said, and then added, they didn't seem like kooks.
He held up a hand at the look on Martin's face.
I'm just saying, I'm sorry I made fun of you.
Martin smiled.
Thanks, man.
Danny jerked his head in acknowledgement. Have fun with those wanted files, he said.
You too, Martin said.
Danny sighed as he pulled away, eyeballing his own file box in the back seat. It was going to be a long night. In the parking garage, Vivian pulled a phone out of her glove compartment. It was prepaid, with cash, and couldn't be traced to her unless someone actually took it out of her car. She almost never used it. She flipped it open now and dialed.
Hello, a man said at the other end.
I hope you boys know what you're doing, because most people who are on the FBI's most wanted list try to avoid contact with the officials, she said.
Vivian, the man said with delight, how you doing?
Dean, she said wearily, your father would...
She didn't finish, because it really was a shame about John Winchester.
Your friend Hendrickson was here today harassing my boys.
Dean laughed. Better them than us, he said. That was like a month ago. Hendrickson's off his game.
Don't underestimate him, Vivian warned. He's good, and he's determined. There's a reason the Bureau put him on your ass.
Dean fifted. We're long gone, he said. I trust there haven't been any more problems?
Not your kind of problems, Vivian confirmed. Then added, thanks.
Any time, Dean said sincerely.
Be careful, Vivian said with a sigh. Take care of each other.
We always do, Dean assured her, and she snapped the phone shut.
Prodigal, a crossover with Dark Angel and an AU of both series. The first time Max met him was in the Manicore basement. She told him she was doing recon. He said that he was snooping around. She figured him for a Manicore flunky and kicked his ass, then left him there. He was back again a week later, trying, the same as her, to get access to the mainframe. She kicked his ass again, and while he could handle himself and probably would thrash any regular human, he was no transgenic, so maybe Max had figured him wrong for a Manicore flunky. She helped him off the floor and allowed us how they might be able to help each other. He grinned and winked at her and offered to scratch her back if she would scratch his. She knocked him back on his ass before he could finish, and she let him pick himself up off the floor. Then she let him help her break into the mainframe room, and they downloaded everything they could get their hands on. He said his name was Ted Nugent, but Max also figured him for a great big liar, so she started thinking of him as Alec in her head, for Smart Alec. Joshua diverted them before they could leave via the basement air duct. X-7s, he said, sniffing around the exit. He pulled apart a sewer cover for them. Strong dog man, Alec commented in the tunnel, and that was all he had to say about Joshua. She blew up Manicore, of course. She'd been headed there for a long time. She let the transgenics out first. Obviously, she's no mass murderer. But then she gathered up a scraggly little group of survivors, and every damn one of them was a kid, and she started to think that maybe just throwing them out into a world they knew nothing about wasn't such a great idea. The kids had been casing a Quickie Mart in No-Tel, actually called the No-Tel Motel, and had clumsily scored some popcorn and candy, but they were pretty much starving, so Max hauled herself over to Skanky Central to buy the kids some food. Who should stroll in but Alec?
Of course, Max said when she rounded the aisle and he was standing there.
Hey, I'm a paying customer. Unlike your little friends who were in here earlier, Alex said, grabbing a couple of sodas and a box of Pop-Tarts. You saw that? Max asked, and Alex snorted. Everyone at the joint saw that. Guess they hadn't reached shoplifting 101 before you blew up their school, he said. Max shifted uneasily. It was a prison, she said. Yeah, a prison that fed and housed them, Alex said flatly. He slapped his food on the counter and then slapped a bill down. Max didn't answer. Alec grabbed his change from the clerk and walked out. Outside, Alec was walking across the stretch of mud that constituted a drive toward the row of sleazy rooms for rent. Hey, Max called after him, and he paused and turned around. You don't know what it was like in there, growing up. Alec nodded, conceding her point. I know what it's like out here, growing up, he said. Max nodded back, conceding his point. See ya, Alec said, and let himself into a room. Bye, Max said feebly as the door shut behind him. Okay, so she'd gotten herself captured by what little remained of Manticore's goon squad, and now she was in a cage beside some lizard guy with the ironic name of Mole. Maybe her game wasn't all it should be. Still, at least she was doing something. Oh, this is nice, someone said. And of course it was Alec, because she'd been wrong. He was a transgenic after all, designed and programmed to ruin Max's life, at every opportunity, with maximum smugness. There was no way that wasn't produced in a lab. Shut up, Max said. Alec grinned at her, then nodded to Mole. Hey, man, he said, and let Mole out of his cage. Later, Max, he said to her, and started to walk away. Mole rolled his eyes and cleared his throat. What's that? Alec said, and cupped a hand to his ear. Oh, right, Max needs my help. I can hear her asking nicely right now. Max looked at Mole, who shrugged. He's got the lockpick. I'd ask nicely, Mole advised. Max ground her teeth. Please, can you let me out? She said. Alec sighed and looked disappointed. I think you can ask nicer than that, but we're kind of pressed for time here, he said, and deftly freed her in seconds. I'll let you show me how nice you can ask some other time, he whispered in her ear as she pushed out of the cage. Max's arm shot out to smash right into his perfect nose and his filthy mouth, but Mole said sharply, We gotta go, now, and she pulled the punch. She'd get another chance to show Alec just how nicely she could ask. It wasn't fun when it rolled around, though, especially because Alec tried to kill both her and Joshua. Trying to stop his head from exploding or not, Max didn't care for almost being murdered. She took it kind of personally. So it was totally beyond her why she ponied up Logan's cure money to have the explosive hacked out of the base of Alec's skull. Thank you, Alec said, still sweating and trembling, once the mad scientist had fled, and Max slammed him up against the wall without pulling her punch one little bit. That money was supposed to get my friend out of his wheelchair, she said, and she was shaking as hard as Alec. Do you think I'm going to get another chance like this? You want to thank me? Get out of my life. Stop crawling around what little is left of Manticore and getting yourself into trouble, and just get the hell out of my life. I'm sorry, Max, Alec whispered, and his eyes were all green sincerity, and she believed him, but she was so furious and frustrated and years beyond the end of her rope that she was afraid she was going to kill him. She backed away from the wall and let him out. Alec glanced over at Joshua and said, Sorry, man. That's okay, Joshua said, because, hey, he only tried to kill you, Joshua, so no biggie. And then Alec was out the door and gone, and at that moment, Max never wanted to lay eyes on him again. You know, you're like, you're back no matter what, and you're just freaking like... Max sputtered weeks later when she went to steal Sammy Sosa's baseball, and there he was, like this thing you thought you'd gotten rid of for good, and you turned around, and it was back, and... Herpes, Alec said. It's like herpes. You think it's gone, and then, wham, there it is again, and it itches so bad, it just drives you crazy, and you know you shouldn't scratch, but you want to so bad, you know it will feel so good if you do, and... Max pushed him, and they swayed on their cables. You're disgusting, she said, and I bet you know from first-hand experience. I am 100% disease-free, Alec said, jostling her back, but I hear things. You look like something in your pants is making you itch, Maxie. Things went downhill from there, until they lost the ball and set off the alarm and ended up racing from the crime scene. When they reached her bike, Max said, "What were you doing there anyway?"
Stealing a very valuable piece of American history," Alex said, and Max grimaced at him.
"No, I mean, what were you going to?" And then she stopped, because she didn't want to know. She didn't want to get drawn into this guy's life. She was going to say goodnight and hope to never run into him again.
Alec cleared his throat awkwardly.
"Pay you back," he said.
"For, you know."
"Saving your life?" Max said dryly.
"Yeah, that," Alec said.
Max shrugged. "I already owed you one," she said.
"Yeah, but yours was free," Alec said.
"I thought maybe if you had the cash, you could find another way to help your friend." Her eyes burned, so she focused on snapping on her driving gloves.
"Don't worry about it," she said tightly.
It might not have even worked, because that was what Logan had said after Ash had opened her big blonde mouth and told him what had happened. Max silently vowed again to never share anything with that one.
Alec coughed.
"Okay," he said, then added, "Hey, can I grab a ride?" Max nodded and swung onto the bike. Alec hopped on behind her.
"Here's a thought," she said as she started it up.
"Why don't you get a job? Try being a respectable citizen for a change."
"That is a thought," Alec said, and chuckled deep in his chest, and it rumbled against Max's back.
She dropped him at the checkpoint because he didn't have a sector pass. God, or whatever, bless Jamponi and its complete inability to keep track of its employees. God, or whatever, damn Jamponi and its complete inability to do background checks on its employees. And while God, or whatever, was at it, damn Normal and his before unknown and horrific love of underground cage fighting.
"What do you think you're doing?" Max hissed at Alec while Normal raved about the godlike wonder that was Zeppelin Overdrive, cage fighter supreme.
"Getting a job. Being a respectable citizen for a change," Alec said.
"Getting a sector pass," Max realized moments later when Normal slapped one down.
"I guess I can't put Zeppelin Overdrive on here," Normal said, and Alec laughed.
"Dean Harrison," he said, and Max actually said, "Oh," in surprise, because somehow she'd completely forgotten that Alec wasn't really this guy's name, and in fact, she never even called him that except in her head. Both Normal and Alec, Dean, gave her a funny look, and then Normal barked, "Hey, Missy, get to work and stop gawking." Max stormed over to her locker and slammed it open and crammed her bag inside. Original Cindy was watching Normal fawn over Alec. "Damn it, Dean," with nauseating idolatry.
"That your boy?" OC said, and Max slammed her locker shut so hard the floor vibrated.
"He's not my boy," she retorted.
"Because you failed to mention that he is one fine specimen of the human male," OC said.
"You don't like men," Max reminded her pointedly.
"That right there is a good reason to rethink my current membership," OC answered. "And seriously, if work turned into an Alec, for the love of all that is holy, Dean, love fest, someone was going to pay, and it was going to hurt." In his first 3 weeks at work, Dean got sketchy, beat up delivering drugs, and slept with two workmates who proceeded to take it out on each other. And really, Max was only pointing out the obvious, that Dean was who they should be mad at, not each other, and there was no reason to say those things to her, because words hurt, you know. At any rate, Normal was nuts if he thought Max was delivering that forgotten package for Dean. He could damn well do it himself, even if it was more out of the way to go to the address Normal had for him than just to deliver the stupid package. Max had to pick her way over a wino and a pile of broken glass up the stairs. She pounded on the door, and when Dean hadn't answered 4.94 seconds later, she pounded again and hollered, "Dean, get out here, because Normal is nuts if he thinks I'm doing your work for you." A skinny boy with floppy hair opened the door, and Max stepped back, confused, but the kid said, "He's not here. You want to leave it?" and pointed at the package held out in her hand.
Max said.
She pressed the package to her chest as though it were valuable. "I better not. It's a work delivery."
"You want to wait?" the kid asked. "He just went to pick up food."
"Okay," Max said slowly, and the kid led her into a lousy little room with peeling wallpaper, a sagging bed, and a moldy couch, which the kid flopped down on. Max became convinced Dean really did live there when she saw the kid was watching a large HD TV that was still shining with newness. "Where did you get that?" Max asked, and sat down next to him. The kid shrugged. "Dean brought it home," he said, as though all things came magically from Dean without explanation. Max expected music videos or cartoons or an action movie, but the kid was watching a PBS documentary on Texas's secession. They were learning about the siege of Governor Perry in the mansion when a foot started thumping on the door. "Sammy!" Dean hollered from outside, and the kid, Sammy apparently, scrambled up and opened the door for Dean, who came in laden with takeout bags. Sammy snagged a couple from him and set them down on the uneven formica table. "That girl from your work is here," Sammy said with a dismissive point at Max before eagerly pulling boxes of food out of the bags. Dean looked at her in surprise and, she almost thought, embarrassment. "Max," he said levelly, "help you with something?" She scooted out of the lumpy couch and held up the package. "You forgot to deliver this," she said lamely, "because, seriously?" Dean was like, she didn't know, raising this kid, and he just brought home dinner, and they were living in this really lousy little ghetto room, and she kind of wanted Alec back because now she felt uneasy about a lot of things she'd said to and thought about Dean, and she didn't like it one bit. "Oh," Dean said, and crossed the room to take it from her. "Thanks, I'll run it out tonight." Max pulled the package back against her chest. "No, I can do it," she said, and Dean gave her an expectant look. "You brought it over here," he pointed out. Max laughed nervously. "Well, yeah, I... And she didn't know what to say. Her eyes flitted away from Dean and landed on Sammy, who had piled food onto a plate and was digging in with enthusiasm, oblivious to anyone else in the room. "Max," Dean said, and he was standing there with his hand out expectantly and a get-on-with-it look on his face. She grimaced and slapped the package into his hand. "Bye, Max," Dean said, then turned his back to her and started piling food onto a plate. "It's good," Sammy said around a mouthful, and Dean answered, "How can you tell? It's not in your mouth long enough to taste it." "Bye," Max said in a tiny voice and let herself out. As she closed the door behind her, she heard Dean ask, "You do your homework?" Whenever Max thought her life couldn't get weirder, somehow it did. Dean was at his locker the next day when she came into work. "Hey," she said, avoiding eye contact and going to her own locker. "Hey," Dean replied neutrally. He shut his locker a minute later and then stood there motionless for a second before coming over to her locker. "Listen," Dean said, so she looked at him. "It's no big deal. It's just my little brother." "Where are your parents?" she asked quietly. "Where are your parents?" he asked, annoyed, and she raised her eyebrows at him. "Oh, right, duh," Dean said. "Bad point. Mom died when Sammy was a baby. Dad's been gone a little while." "Where'd he go?" she asked in the same quiet voice. "Nosy," Dean complained, looking at the floor. Max waited. "Dunno," Dean said. "Went out and didn't come back." He looked back up at her. "He didn't leave us, though. He turned his face away, and Max said quietly, "Okay." "Okay," Dean echoed. He took a deep breath and steadied. "Anyway, me and Sammy now. I try to keep him away from all this." And Dean waved his hand around Jamponi, but Max knew he meant the drug dealing and the stealing and whatever the hell he'd been doing at Manicore. "Yeah," Max said, then felt she needed to give something back for barging into his home and maybe into his life in a way that maybe she didn't have a right to. "Dean, it's no big deal. It's just your kid brother, right?" Dean's eyes searched her face, and then he smiled, a real smile, for the first time since she'd known him. "Thanks, Max," he said. "Sure," she answered. She sat on the bench to change shoes, and he started to walk away. "Dean," she called out, stopping him. She looked up as she tied her shoes. "Be careful out there. That stuff, when we first met?" Dean jerked his chin. "You don't want to go out and not come home to Sammy." "Never," he said. During the next few weeks, Dean scammed Joshua into doing his Jamponi work. Okay, so Joshua loved it, but Dean shouldn't take advantage. Then scammed Max into working at a girly bar. Okay, so they saved that Gil girl? But come on, she had to sit on his lap. Max was also pretty sure he slept with Asha, not that she cared. He also brought Sammy with him to crash and somehow batted his eyes until the bartender relented and poured Sammy a soda, then told Dean he'd better not regret this. The bartender probably didn't have regrets, but Logan did, when it turned out his pool table hustle of Dean was really Sammy and Dean's pool table hustle of Logan. A fool and his money, Logan said bemusedly, as he wheeled around the table and forked over bills to a half-delighted, half-nervous Sammy, and then bought the kid dinner. He made Dean buy his own food. You shouldn't bring a kid into a place like this, Max sniped at Dean. But original Cindy gave her that knowing look. You and I both went to worse when we were his age and didn't walk out with a wad of cash, she said, and then poured two squeaks of beer into an empty glass for Sammy. Max hummed and sat by herself while original Cindy corrupted and sketchy fawn, and Logan enjoyed himself, and Dean watched his little brother have a good time with pleasure. Max glowered, but it was kind of a waste with no one watching. Stupid friends. Hey, girlie, Normal hollered as soon as she walked in. Try to keep your rent boys out of the joint, hmm? Then jerked a thumb over at the bench by the office window. Sammy was sitting there, hunched into his jacket, backpack at his feet. She didn't quite move at true transgenic speed, but it was close, and original Cindy caught her by the elbow to slow her. Sammy, hey, she said, sitting down beside him and taking in his pinched expression. What's wrong? Dean never came home last night, he said, and anxiously turned his phone over and over in his hand. He doesn't pick up his phone. I don't know where he went, and I didn't know where else to go, and I don't have anyone's number. When'd he leave? O.C. asked, standing in front of Sammy. Like 9, maybe 10, Sammy said. Said he'd be back in a couple hours, had to go check on something. The kid's eyes were hollow, and Max wondered if he'd slept at all. He wouldn't do that. Not without calling and telling me. And he always calls to check on me if he's out late, and I didn't know who else to tell. It's all right, Max said, and put a hand on Sammy's arm. I'll find him. It didn't seem right to take Sammy back to that lousy rented room and leave him there all alone, and Logan thought that his place was being watched lately, so Max punted. Joshua and Sammy regarded each other with open curiosity, and then Joshua asked Sammy if he liked mac and cheese with little hot dogs in it, and Sammy said it was his favorite, so Max figured they were all set. God, or whatever, blessed Logan and his uber-hacking skills, because he found an alarm that had tripped the night before with no prowler discovered. Max was going to kick Dean's ass for scaring Sammy over some stupid, easy B&E, but then she found the place, and it was a freaking fortress of booby traps that extended to its huge acreage. It was twilight by then, so original Cindy and Sketchy came out to help her look, but she ended up the one who almost tripped over Dean in the dwindling light because he'd half-hidden himself in the shrubbery. You're such a jackass, she said angrily when he finally opened his eyes, and Dean smiled and said hoarsely, Always knew you cared, Maxie. Max had a long response ready for that, but then Dean said, I left Sammy home alone. You gotta call him. I lost my phone. So she just said, Sammy's fine. Who do you think sent us out here looking for you? Your fairy godmother?
Good, Dean said, and his eyes slid back shut.
The three of them managed to carry him back to the road and load him into Logan's car. The dome light revealed a bloody scalp, a massively bruised torso, and a hugely swollen ankle.
He probably fell, Logan said, and then started the car.
Harbor Lights ER?
Max hesitated, and Sketchy looked at her in confusion.
He's a mess. We gotta take him to a doctor, he said.
What if he's wanted for something, Original Cindy pointed out. You know he's always dealing drugs and stealing things. You gonna finish raising Sammy if he gets ID'd at the ER?
Let's just get him back to Joshua's and get him cleaned up. See how bad it is, Max said.
Logan gave her a disapproving look in the rearview mirror, but put the car in gear and headed to Joshua's.
It wasn't as bad as it looked. Of course, lying in the damp, cold bushes half the night and then all day hadn't done Dean any favors, but they cleaned him up and got him into warm, dry clothes and piled blankets on top of him, and when he came around, they forced hot tea down him.
Thanks, was all Dean feebly had to say, but he never looked at the tea held to his mouth because his eyes never left Sammy, hovering at the foot of the bed.
Original Cindy wrapped the ankle and then elevated it, and they put a cool pack on it, then warm packs on his torso.
Dean muttered, thanks, again, but his eyes were shut, and then he was out.
Sammy didn't want to go to bed, so Max let him pull the musty armchair over to Dean's bed and sit there, then chased everyone else out of the room. 10 minutes later, Joshua carried a soundly sleeping Sammy to a bed of his own and tucked him in.
Little puppies need sleep, he said to Max, and petted Sammy's hair before leaving the room.
Logan had waited in the car, because Joshua's flop house wasn't exactly handicapped accessible, and he hated Joshua carrying him in. Max ran out to say goodbye and see if he could give OC and Sketchy a ride home. He was finishing a phone call as he rolled the window down.
He's doing better, she said when he snapped the phone shut. I'm gonna stay, make sure he's all right.
Good, Logan said. That house? The one Dean was breaking into?
Yeah, Max said.
It was starting to mist, and she shoved her hands into her pockets and shivered. It belongs to Robert Beresford, a genetic engineer. Not a scientist himself, but a smart investor in the sciences, Logan said. His closest ties were to a group called Latinoc.
A subsidiary of Manicore, Max said, and Logan nodded grimly.
Look, Max, Logan said, and she clenched her jaw. He held up a placating hand.
I like Dean, too. But you don't really know anything about him. You never even found out what he was doing at Manicore when you first met.
Max wanted to pick a fight, to say Logan was just suspicious, Logan was just petty, Logan was just jealous. Of what, she didn't want to put her finger on. But it was cold, and she was tired of fighting with Logan.
I doubt he's on their side if he's breaking in and stealing from them, she said instead, and Logan nodded.
But that doesn't mean his agenda is your agenda, he said.
Okay, Max said, and stepped away from the car.
Take OC and Sketchy home?
Fine, Logan said curtly, and rolled his window back up.
Max went to sleep in the armchair in Dean's room, and woke when she heard him shifting around.
All right, she asked, and turned on the bedside light.
Dean was panting and in a light sweat, but he rallied up a leer.
There's something here about you finally sleeping with me. Give me a minute, he said weakly.
She rolled her eyes and gave him some water instead, then moved pillows around until he was more comfortable.
Better, she asked, sitting at the edge of the bed, and Dean caught hold of her hand.
Max, he said, but there was no leer to it, so she didn't pull away. He closed his eyes and his ragged breath started to even out. She thought he'd fallen back asleep and was about to extract her hand and stand up. But he must have felt her shift because his fingers tightened and he opened his eyes.
It's Sammy, he said. They're after Sammy.
Who? Max asked, then realized what he was saying.
Manicore.
Dean nodded.
Why? Max asked.
He can't possibly be one of us.
Dean swallowed. He was sweating again.
Sammy has these dreams, he said, and sometimes they come true.
Come again, Max said.
because that couldn't be right, but somehow she knew that it was. When our mom died, this guy was in Sammy's room, Dean said, over his crib, and Mom got up, I don't know, Sammy was crying or something, and she screamed, and it woke us up, and the house was on fire, and Dad came running out of the nursery and put Sammy in my arms, and he said to run outside, fast as I could, and not look back, and I did, I left them there, but he came out alone, and Dean was crying, and Max didn't think he even knew. The cop said it was a home invasion, but Dad never believed it. What kind of burglar walks by the television and computer and stereo and goes into the baby's room? Mom was already hurt, he told me later, and the guy was out cold, and Sammy screaming in his crib, and this smell in the air. Dad was a Marine, did 2 tours in Iraq, said the smell was chemical, and he knew the place was going up. I don't know how he got out, but he never made it back in the room to Mom. Max folded both of her hands tight over Dean's. How do you know it was Manicore? She asked. Dean shrugged. Dad put it together, he said. He knew something was wrong after the fire, so he took off with us. I don't think he knew back then. When Sammy was 5 or 6, he started having these nightmares, and sometimes he told me about them. And then I'd find out later that the things he dreamed about, they'd happened to people we knew. I told Dad and, I don't know, I think he already knew, or suspected at least. But he's yours, right? Max asked. Then clarified, I mean, he's your parents' kid? Dean nodded. I remember Mom being pregnant, no barcode, and until the dream started, he was totally normal. I don't know, maybe they did something to him to cause the dreams, or maybe they want him because of the dreams, want to poke around in his DNA. Dad knew more, but he kept his secrets. He told me about Manicore, though, told me he was coming to Seattle to check out this facility they had here. And then he didn't come home, Max said quietly. And then I blew the place up. Dean squeezed her fingers. Max didn't know what else to say, so she wiped his damp face off and pulled the blankets up. I don't think he was there, Dean said hoarsely. At least, not by the time I made it to Seattle and found Manicore. You should talk to Logan, she said. He might be able to find something out for you. About your dad, or about Sammy. Yeah, Dean said thickly, looking exhausted in the dim light. Dad wasn't big on teaching us to trust people. Max rested her palm on the blankets, over Dean's chest. He had his reason, she said. Dean looked at her miserably until his eyes slid shut. Max shut off the light and went to the door, then paused. Dean, she said, and he was still awake, said huskily, yeah. I put Logan in that wheelchair, she said into the darkness. I know, Dean said, but not on purpose. Max didn't think it would console Dean if they found out that she burned his father alive, but not on purpose. Max, Dean said, and she didn't answer. I stole your research on Sandman. On purpose. You're such an ass, Dean, shot out of her mouth without filter, and then she laughed. All right, you didn't give it to Joshua for an art project, did you? It's at the apartment, Dean said. There's a place under the floorboards. Sammy'll show you. Fine, Max said. Go to sleep, Dean. You know, Dean started, and she shut the door on the rest. Dean couldn't work for a while as he healed up, and Joshua couldn't get enough of feeding Sammy mac and cheese with little hot dogs, so they made a strange little family, or litter, or pack, or whatever. The house smelled like wet dog and grimy boys and books and paint, and Max kind of loved it there, but only because she loved Joshua and Sammy. During the next few months, Dean scammed an art gallery into paying exorbitant prices for Joshua's paintings. Okay, so he split the money with Joshua, but come on, Joshua's art was free and natural expression, and Dean just went and commercialized it, then got scammed into returning to the cage fighting ring. Okay, so it's good money, but you know, it's cage fighting. Max isn't going to mention the run-in with the penis monster, which totally was not her fault no matter what Dean said, and anyway, they agreed to pretend it never happened. Max broke up with Logan for good, and she didn't want to talk about it. More people started to talk about transgenics as if they might actually be real, and not some creepy urban legend like alien bounty hunters, and while by now they were an actual underground, organized and united, it was getting harder and harder to find and then hide their people. Max dreamed of her childhood, of Manicore, of training, of testing, and she woke up shaking and crawled into Original Cindy's bed, and her friend held her until she could breathe again. The jig was up once the network started airing footage of sector guards being attacked by that desperate, terrified transgenic. Max stopped researching at all. She devoted all of her time to getting transgenics out of the city and to safe houses. Logan was liquidating and bankrupting himself to fund Max's Underground Railroad, and while most days she couldn't look him in the eyes, she needed his help. Mole was gearing up for warfare, and Joshua left the brothers at his house and joined the resistance soldiers in Terminal City. Asha and her people had left, just gone overnight, and White wasn't a concern anymore. Now they were all dodging NSA agents. Dean never missed a night's work at her side. With Joshua gone, Sammy usually slept at the apartment with Original Cindy. He was teaching her to hustle poker. Dean would poke him awake and haul him off the couch when they finished up, and Max would drive them back to the house, Sammy wedged between her and his brother on the bike. So she was surprised when she left the apartment one morning and Sammy was sitting out at the curb waiting for her. "Hey," she said, "Dean'll kick your ass for cutting school." Sammy looked up at her, his face scrunched up with worry. "I had a dream about you," he said, and she sat down beside him. "It won't happen like that," she said when he'd finished. "You said people can change them, your dreams, right?" Sammy nodded, and she put an arm around his shoulder. "So, no way I'm letting it go down like that." "Okay." Sammy looked up at her from under his floppy bangs. She gave him a squeeze and then stood up. When he stood up beside her, she realized with shock that he'd grown taller than her in the time she'd known him. "Go to school," Max said. "I'll see you tonight." "Bye, Max," he said, and walked away, a skinny kid with a loaded-down backpack in a ruined city. "Bye, Sammy," she breathed, and wrapped her arms around herself against the sudden chill. She never saw him again, or Dean. She couldn't remember, later, what she and Dean had even talked about that last night, if she'd even said goodbye, or goodnight, or good luck. Things went that way sometimes. Clemente said he would transfer her himself after Terminal City fell. When he pulled the car over to the side of the road and told her to get out, she thought he was going to kill her, but instead he let her go. He told her to run and not look back. One of her specialties. She never went back to Seattle. There were other survivors, scattered now and weakened, but she sometimes found ways to connect. It wasn't the same, though. It was like losing her brothers and sisters all over again. She was mawing on chicken wings and slopping them down with cheap beer at a truck stop bar when someone at her elbow said in disbelief, "Max?" She glanced up at the tall, lanky man with floppy hair. "Yeah," she said, and viciously yanked more meat off the bone. "It's Sam, Sam Winchester," he said, and she raised her eyebrows because she'd never heard the name. "No," he shook his head. "Sorry, Harrison. Sam Harrison. Sammy." Max choked, and he whacked her between the shoulders because, holy crap, suddenly she could see a skinny kid with floppy hair who used to ride on her bike, safely wedged between her and his brother. "Sammy," she said when she'd recovered, and reached up to put her arms around him, laughing. "Sammy, you got tall." "Yeah," he said, and hugged her back. Must have been all that nutritious mac and cheese. She pulled back, and they studied each other, smiling widely. "I don't believe it," she said. "Wow." "I know, Sammy." "No, Sam," said. "I'm so glad you're all right. We were never able to find out." Her heart squeezed at the "we," and she nodded, her voice hitching slightly. "So, Dean?" "Right here," someone said at her elbow, and boy, speak of the devil. "Hey, Max." "Hi, Dean," she said, and they stood there staring, not hugging, and then they seemed to feel silly at the same moment and went in for a friendly hug. She took her food back to their table, and Dean ordered them shots, and then she ordered them shots, and then Sammy, for crying out loud, Sam, ordered them beer, because, Dean said, she could clearly see that he'd grown up to be a pussy. She knew about some people they'd never been able to find out about, and they knew about some others that she'd never been able to find out about, the awesomest of which was that Norma was some kind of grand guru in Malia Obama's grassroots movements to restore voting rights. Dean said he kind of thought Normal just went around telling everyone to get back to work. When Sammy, seriously, was she brain damaged? Sam, went to the bathroom, Max and Dean just sat and stared across the table at each other, unable to keep the small talk up on their own. Yeah, Dean said finally, and took a hearty swig of beer. Yep, Max said, and followed suit. You ever find your dad? She asked when she set down the beer. Dean shook his head. Never found out what happened to him, he said, then asked, Logan? Dead, Max said simply. Dean nodded, then held up his beer bottle in salute. Max clinked hers against it, and they drank. Fear the Reaper, a crossover with Psych. 1987. Sean! Henry loomed over his son. I hope you know you're cleaning up this mess. What are you doing with all of this anyway? Sean and Gus peered up over the back of the couch. They were heavily armed with cooking utensils. It's a fortress, Dad, Sean said. For the zombie apocalypse, Gus added eagerly. Well, that's no good, Henry said. Boys, a zombie fortress needs to be unbreachable. Zombies are unresting, unflagging, untiring, undead machines with only one goal, to eat your brains. You think this flimsy construct is going to stop them? Henry held his arms out in front of him and moaned, then began walking until he hit the couch. The couch stopped his stride, but his feet just kept moving. See, it worked, Sean said. For now, Henry said, feet still moving and arms still out. But the thing about zombies is, there's never just one. As soon as the others hear me moaning, they're going to know there's fresh meat over this way, and they're going to come dragging along. They'll start piling up, crushing up against me, until... Henry tipped himself over the back of the couch at the boys, righted himself, and came at them, arms outstretched, moaning at top volume. Gus screamed and broke through the back wall of cushions. His feet pounded up the stairs. Dad, Sean said in exasperation, it's just for fun. Henry bent over and pointed his finger in Sean's face. Zombies, he told his son sternly, are not just for fun. You either take them seriously or you end up one of them. Sean rolled his eyes. 2009. Sean staggered into the police station, bent over his blood-stained torso. He leaned against the closest wall, panting. Sean, Buzz said, stopping and holding out an arm. Are you all right? Sean moaned, then slowly straightened up. Another moan came from his blood-ringed mouth, and then his arm straightened out in front of his body as he shuffled toward Buzz, who took an uncertain step back. Lassiter stopped in the hallway and rolled his eyes. Stop screwing around, Spencer, he said, then continued walking, muttering, Every single Halloween. Sean's arms flew out to his sides. Lassie, come on, he protested. Where's your holiday spirit? Buzz grinned. Oh, I get it, he said. Great zombie costume, Sean. Had you nervous, didn't I, buddy? Sean said proudly. And this isn't the all-out version. That's got my intestines hanging out. Awesome, Buzz said, giving him a thumbs up before continuing on his way. Sean preened a little under Buzz's adoration. It was good to have fans of his work. Sean wandered over to Juliet's desk. Hey, Jules, he said, then grinned happily when she looked up and jumped at his blood-spattered appearance. Sean, please, she said, and went back to typing furiously. Some of us have to work for a living. Every day, Sean told her, you sound more like Lassiter. Juliet grimaced. We're just really busy right now, she said. Sean wondered what it was like to be busy. It didn't sound fun. So let me lighten the load, he said magnanimously. Throw some work my way. We don't really have anything we need you on right now, Juliet said absently, squinting at her computer screen. Nothing, Sean pestered, because while busy sounded not fun, money sounded like rent. No unsolved murders or some nice easy kidnapping I can take off your hands? Here, Spencer, Lassiter said, appearing out of nowhere with a file in his hand. "You want some work to do? Give this a shot." "I'm getting paid for this, right?" Sean said to Lassiter's departing bat. No one answered. "What kind of case is this again?" Gus asked as they got out of the car. Sean headed up the walk steps. "Assault and home invasion," he said over his shoulder. "That's pretty standard," Gus said, catching up to him as he rang the doorbell. "Why do they need us on it?" "They're just a little overwhelmed down at the station right now," Sean said. "Just trying to show them that we're team players." The door opened to reveal an elderly woman with thick glasses. She was leaning on a heavy wooden cane. "Mrs. Moore?" Sean asked. "I'm Sean Spencer, the head psychic at the Santa Barbara Police Department, and this is my associate, Drizzle McFarley." Gus nodded politely at Mrs. Moore. "I'm here to talk to you about the break-in and assault." Mrs. Moore served them a hot drink in delicate little china cups with saucers. Sean was pretty sure the drink was Theraflu with a little whiskey for flavor. "I hope you weren't hurt in the incident, Mrs. Moore," Gus told her. She smiled sweetly at him. "Oh, no, nothing I couldn't handle," she said, and gave her cane a shake. "More tea?" "No, I'm fine, Mrs. Moore," Sean said. "Why don't you tell us what happened?" Mrs. Moore sat down and poured herself a cup. "Well, I was cleaning up in the kitchen when I heard this racket on the back porch. Sounded like nails dragging on the steps. The next thing I know, something is rattling at the doggy door, but I had it locked. I thought it must be a stray, so I opened the door to shoo it away, and that's when Harry came in." "You knew your attacker?" Gus asked. "Knew him," Mrs. Moore said. "We lived together for 13 years. You can imagine my surprise. Oh, and was he ever filthy, covered in dirt and grime and smelling something terrible. I still haven't quite got rid of all the smell." "So you let Harry in," Sean said. "Of course," Mrs. Moore said. "You didn't think he'd open the door by himself, did you?" "Did you and Harry part on bad terms?" Gus asked. Sean looked around the room and noticed the old dog bed in the corner, the end of a leash dangling off the coat rack, and the corgi statuettes in the curio cabinet. "Harry and I never exchanged cross words in our lives," Mrs. Moore said, slightly indignant. "Well, not until that night. He tried to bite me. In fact, I think he would have eaten me if he could have. I had to beat his skull in with my cane. It was quite horrible." She serenely sipped her tea. "You beat his skull in?" Gus asked, and his voice cracked. "Did he die?" "A curious question," Mrs. Moore said with a contemplative sigh. "Mrs. Moore," Sean asked, "where is Harry now?" "Oh, I buried him in the backyard," she said matter-of-factly. Gus looked like he might faint. "I'm so sorry for your loss," Sean said. Lassiter was going to pay for this, but the look on Gus's face was making up for a lot of it. "Did you have him tested for rabies first?" Gus looked from Sean to Mrs. Moore and back to Sean. "Harry is a dog?" he demanded. "A corgi, if I'm not mistaken," Sean said, and Mrs. Moore beamed with delight. "My goodness, you are a psychic," she said, and poured Sean more Theraflu whiskey. "And I didn't see the need for a rabies test, now did I?" Sean stood up and clapped his hands together lightly. "Mrs. Moore," he gave her a bobbing bow of thanks, "we're so glad you're all right. Just wanted to follow up and make sure everything was okay now." "Thank you, dear," she said sweetly. "You young men are so much nicer than that crankety fellow I got transferred to when I called the police department." Gus waited until Mrs. Moore had shown them out and shut the door behind them. "Harry's a dog," he informed Sean. "Hmm," Sean said, reviewing the conversation. He turned around and knocked on Mrs. Moore's door again. "One last thing, Mrs. Moore," he said when she answered. "Why was the doggy door locked?" "Well, there wasn't much use for it after Harry died, was there?" she said. "But Harry was still alive," Gus said. "She means," Sean said, looking at Mrs. Moore's tranquil face, "after Harry died the first time." "You're hysterical, Lassie," Sean said, striding up to Lassiter's desk. The detective didn't look up, but he started smiling evilly. "What do you think, Spencer? Should I file charges against Mrs. Moore's corgi for assault? He asked.
Actually, you may want to think about filing murder charges against Mrs. Moore, Sean shot back.
Oh, wait, is it double jeopardy if Harry was already dead when she bashed his head in?
Lassiter got up and strode across the room toward the chief's office.
I thought you'd like that, he said. A little Halloween twist on the story.
Did you get a whiff of her kitchen? Sean asked.
Smelled like decomposing doggy to me.
Right, Lassiter said, deadpan. I'll get right on that. Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to go solve some crimes committed by live human suspects.
Sean let him stomp off. He had things to think about.
What are you doing here already? Gus demanded, striding into the psych office.
Sean jiggled in his seat in front of the laptop. He couldn't really stop, given the 2 or 3 pots of coffee he'd consumed over the night.
Gus, he said, and he knew he needed to take it down a notch, but again, coffee.
Did you sleep here? Gus asked, frowning.
No, Sean assured him. I've been working. Come here, you have to see this.
Gus came around the desk and his frown deepened.
Sean, you're watching Zombieland trailers, he said.
Not exactly billable hours.
But it is, Sean said in delight.
He minimized Zombieland with a silent apology.
Check this out.
Gus leaned in and peered over Sean's shoulder.
Zombie cats roam neighborhood, he read.
Looking up the browser, he saw that it was a brief in the Santa Barbara News Press.
Sean, this is just some Halloween piece they stuck in the briefs, he said.
Sean nodded. It made his brains rattle in his head.
Yeah, that's why they put it in at all. But people are actually reporting this, he said, and started pulling other browsers to the front.
Gus's breath huffed on his neck in surprise.
Dude, Gus said, that is whack.
You are so white, Sean said, then pushed Gus out of the way.
Come on, we need to go talk to these people.
The Clevelands, 2 blocks over from Mrs. Moore, confirmed that their beloved Kirk had clawed his way out of his backyard grave and was now at large. The Redmonds had not seen their poor little Pippin, but there was a hole in their yard where he'd been put to rest. And Mr. Hall confessed that he had run the neighbor's Chihuahua rat dog over with his car, only to have it come snapping and growling to life in his hands while he guiltily walked her remains home.
This neighborhood is like ground zero for zombie pet activity, Sean told Gus while they walked up to the Amman's house.
Little name I had posted on MySpace about the hamster and parrot arising from the dead.
Gus didn't answer. Sean thought Gus might be having a few issues with the living pet dead.
As Sean pressed the doorbell button, the door opened and 2 tall men in suits walked out. They stood on the porch and surveyed Sean and Gus. Sean and Gus sized them both up. Sean wasn't sure what Gus concluded, but he concluded that these dudes were tall.
Hello, an annoyed little person said from the open door.
Judging by her Jonas Brothers t-shirt, Sean thought he'd found Nema.
Nema, he said. I'm Sean Spencer, the head psychic at the Santa Barbara Police Department, and this is my associate, Alec Baldwin.
Gus waved to her.
I emailed you about Scooby and Scrappy.
You don't look like a psychic, Nema said.
Sean laughed as fakely as he could.
How would you know what a psychic looks like, he asked.
Nema wrinkled her nose at him. Besides, I just talked to these guys from the Center for Disease Control, she said, and pointed at the suits.
The suits looked highly amused.
Head psychic, huh, the least tall suit said.
Nice sandals.
Yeah, well, nice tie, Sean said, because he was caught off guard, because, dude, they were nice sandals.
The Santa Barbara Police Department has time to investigate hamster and parrot deaths, the most tall suit said.
Gus scoffed.
Like the CDC does, he said.
How about some ID?
We'll show you ours if you show us yours, the least tall suit said. And man, that was dirty. While the suits were looking at Sean and Gus's Knight Rider fan club membership cards, they had business cards, but come on, he wasn't wasting them on these 2 wannabes. Sean and Gus examined their nearly authentic IDs. Sean returned Agent Hamill's ID, and Gus returned Agent Ford's ID. They all sized each other up for another moment.
Unless you're going to fight or something cool, get off my porch, Nema said.
They all turned to look at her, and she slammed the door shut.
Huh, Gus said.
Kids these days, Sean said, shaking his head.
The suits were halfway down the walk.
Good luck with your psychic stuff, the most tall suit called over his shoulder. And those sandals, the least tall suit added. They got into a cherry black muscle car that would kill any real CDC agent dead from its awesomeness. Where do those guys get off, pretending to be something they're not? Sean said to Gus as they watched them drive off. They tailed the suits back through the neighborhood and then to a diner. Gus waited in the car while Sean ran up the street to a different diner and grabbed them lunch. What? They can't tail really tall suits on an empty stomach. After they ate, the most tall suit made a series of calls and took notes, while the least tall suit flirted with the waitress and seemingly got free pie for his efforts. As they left the diner and got back into the sweet muscle car, the least tall suit waved to Sean and Gus. Maybe if someone had a less conspicuous car, things like this wouldn't happen, Sean sniped at Gus. Maybe if someone had a car at all, he could follow these guys around all on his own, Gus retorted. That's why I don't have a car, Sean pointed out. They followed the suits back to Mrs. Moore's neighborhood and watched as they approached a house with a for sale sign in the yard and shook hands with a young woman waiting on the porch. She was wearing a smart little suit and had a folder clutched in her hand. There's no undead animals here, Gus said. No one even lives there. Hmm, Sean said, whipping out his phone. Who are you texting? Gus asked, leaning over. Sean pushed him away. Nema, he said. That has the potential to be seriously creepy, Sean, Gus admonished, and Sean gave him a scathing look, because please. She said, Sean continued a few minutes later when his phone beeped back at him, that this house is supposed to be haunted. A haunted house and a bunch of zombie pets, Gus asked. Sounds pretty far-fetched, even for us. Yeah, Sean said, fingers flying over his phone. Nema also says this house totally isn't actually haunted and is really, really lame. I'm glad you're getting your research from 11-year-olds now, Sean, Gus said. It's a new highlight in your career. Kids know everything, Sean said, and then got out of the car because the suits had just emerged from the house with their realtor. Agents, he said, strolling up while Gus scrambled behind him. Mr. Spencer, the least tall suit said. Hey, Sophie, these are the guys we were telling you about. This is Mr. Spencer and his life partner, Mr. Baldwin. Hi, Sophie said with I need this commission cheer. The agents were just telling me that they're friends with a couple in town who are in the market. I'd love to take you inside. This is a great starter home. And it's just been declared CDC clear, the most tall suit said. I think it's great for you too. Oh, Sean said, I don't know. He turned to Gus. Do you think we're Cape Cod kind of people? I was really thinking of something more modern. Come on in and take a look before you decide, Sophie said. It's all remodeled inside. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised. We'll leave you to it, the most tall suit said as they strolled by Sean and Gus. Happy hunting, the least tall suit called over his shoulder. Sophie, who was cute enough to make the house viewing tolerable, showed them all the renovations and adorable features with meticulous detail. Sean soon stopped feigning interest, but he thought Gus really liked the place. Sophie, we're going to go home and talk about it, he declared at the end of their tour. Thank you so much, Gus told her. Sure, Sophie bubbled, handing Gus her card. My cell's on there, so if you have any questions, if you want to see it again, just give me a call, anytime. One question, Sean said. Our buddies from before, Agents Hamill and Ford, they're here checking out some pet disease in the neighborhood. If we decided to adopt some sweet, furry little thing, it's not at any risk, is it? Sophie blanched. Oh, no, she rushed to reassure him. Any pet you brought home would be perfectly safe. Check with your friends, really. Good to know, Sean said. Gus has his heart set on a Shih Tzu. Jules, Sean said, strolling up to her desk. It was vacant. Juliet, Sean asked, wandering around the hallway. He reached out to open the records room door, but the door swung in before his hand grasped the knob. Juliet emerged, pink-cheeked and slightly breathless. Most tall suit came out of the room after her. Mr. Spencer, he said smugly, and walked away. Sean, Juliet said impatiently, like maybe she'd said his name a few times while he stood there hearing rushing white noise in his ears. Yeah, Sean answered with a start. Hey, Jules, I wanted to ask you about something. He pointed, involuntarily, at Most Tall Suit's departing figure.
The pet problem, Juliet said.
Sean, I'm so sorry Carlton dumped that on you. It looks like it's a public health problem, and not even a police matter.
Sean jerked a thumb over his shoulder in the general direction Most Tall Suit had been walking.
And there, the CDC guys are...
Juliet reached out to pat Sean on the arm. He noticed that her blouse was misbuttoned.
They're taking care of it, Sean. Again, really sorry about Carlton. And she was off.
Sean decided that he needed to lie down, right away. The chief's office was great for that.
The blinds were shut, so he was extending his hand to knock when the door swung inward.
Least Tall Suit emerged, straightening his tie.
Mr. Spencer, he said smugly, and left the building.
Sean thought he might pass out.
Mr. Spencer, the chief said impatiently, like maybe she'd said his name a few times while his head was spinning.
I'm sorry, Chief. I was having a little vision there, Sean said, putting his fingers to his temples.
Those guys, those CDC guys, they aren't who they say they are. You should really check up on them.
Chief Vic put her hands on her hips.
Mr. Spencer, do you think I just let people stroll into my city and start investigations without knowing who they are? I spoke to their supervisor, Dr. Lucas, earlier today, and they are completely legitimate. Now, do you need something else?
I have no idea, Sean said. I don't know what's happening.
Well, you let me know when you figure it out, the chief said, and turned on her heel and went back into her office.
This is stupid, Sean, Gus said.
Shh, Sean said. Don't blow our cover.
Cover, Gus hissed. These are tombstones, Sean. They're not cover. They're an invitation for very bad, horrible things to come out of the ground and get us.
Be a man, Gus, Sean said, and peered around his tombstone.
The suits, now in jeans and T-shirts, had stopped digging up the grave and were debating something. They looked through the duffel bag they brought with them, but clearly couldn't find what they were looking for.
Most Tall Suit pointed a finger at Least Tall Suit.
Least Tall Suit made yapping gestures with his hands at Most Tall Suit.
Most Tall Suit didn't like that at all and threw his hands up in the air.
What are they doing? Gus whispered.
I don't know, Sean said. Looks like they finished digging up the grave, but now they're having another argument.
Sean, Gus said, don't you think that if the phrase finished digging up the grave is part of the sentence, that it's time to call the police?
Shh, Sean said.
Besides, it's not as weird as when they were lying on the graves and listening with stethoscopes.
He had to admit, that had been super weird.
When Sean peered around the tombstone again, the suits were walking toward their car.
Most Tall Suit was still waving his arms around.
Sean made a break for the open grave as soon as the suits were out of sight.
Sean, Gus squawked, and there was no way the suits didn't hear that.
Sean jumped right into the grave. Gus's terrified face appeared above him.
What are you doing, Sean? Gus demanded. Are you insane?
Sean's heart was pounding in his ears.
Just wait, Gus, he said, holding up a hand.
I think I've got this. I think it's gotta be.
He started bouncing up and down on the casket.
Gus, do you know what's going on here? He yelled in delight. Do you know what's inside this casket?
And Gus didn't get a chance to answer because something started pounding and moaning inside the coffin, and then a decomposing hand broke through and grabbed Sean's ankle.
All right, so maybe he screamed like an itty-bitty girl, but at least he didn't run all the way back to the office in terror, no doubt screaming the whole way. The suits were awesome. Most Tall Suit jumped into the grave, stomped the hand, breaking off a couple of its fingers, shoved Sean up the side to Least Tall Suit, pried open the coffin with a crowbar, and jumped effortlessly out of the grave. Least Tall Suit neatly chopped the head off the thing that came crawling out of the grave with an axe.
Then the two of them shoved it back inside, closed the coffin, and filled the grave back up.
Sean would have helped, but first he had to go behind a grave and piddle, and then he had to lie on the ground and shake all over.
The suits continued on their new mission of awesomeness and gave Sean a ride back to the office.
Then they reverted to their original mission of dickishness and
and invited themselves in. They took food out of the fridge and put their muddy boots on the furniture. It was enough to draw Gus out of his bathroom fortress position. "So, agents," Sean said. "Dean," said Lee's tall suit. He was sitting in Sean's chair with his feet on the desk. "Sam," said Mo's tall suit. He was sitting in one of the armchairs with his feet on the coffee table. "Dean, Sam," Sean said. "That was a zombie."
"You should have heard you screaming," Dean said, laughing and pointing at Sean with his spoon.
"That's great, thanks," Sean said. "But back to the problem at hand. You see, I'm a psychic, and I'm sensing that..."
"You're not a psychic," Sam said flatly.
"How would you know?" Sean asked. He liked these guys better when they were being awesome and saving him from flesh-eating zombies. Sam glowered at him.
"I wouldn't test him out on this, Spencer," Dean said mildly.
"Okay, whatever," Sean said impatiently. "I think the question here is how undead pets have now become undead persons." Dean continued eating Sean's very special Chunky Monkey ice cream out of the carton. Sam stopped eating his leftover Chinese and fished a folded piece of paper out of his jacket pocket and handed it to Sean. Sean smoothed it out on the table, and Gus came to look over his shoulder. "The X's are places that had zombie pets?" he asked, and the agents hummed in agreement.
"It's radiating outward," Sean said.
"And now it's reached the graveyard," Dean confirmed. "So unless we want to dig up every body planted there, whack its head off, and replant it, we gotta find out what started this and reverse it." Sean tilted his head to get a better look at the map. His finger landed near the center of the X's. "The house that's for sale," he said.
"That's ground zero," Sam confirmed. "But it's clean."
Gus nodded.
"Right. The realtor said no pet problems there," he said.
"Yeah, but it's clean," Dean said. "No history, no EMF, no cold spots, nada."
"Dude," Gus said. "You guys are like ghost facers, aren't you?"
Sam choked. Dean threw down his spoon in disgust.
"Dude," he yelled at Sam, "would you get us a website or something? Because I swear, the next time this happens..."
Sam rolled his eyes.
"Something like that," he said to Gus.
"But way, way cooler," Dean said, "and way more badass. And not, you know, lame."
"Clearly," Sean said. "Back to the zombie apocalypse. You know that people think that house is haunted, even though it's not, right?"
The agents shook their heads.
"We went there because it's the center of activity," Sam said.
"Well, I have it on good authority that everyone in the neighborhood thinks that house is haunted," Sean said, and Gus snorted.
"It's not," Dean said.
"Yeah," Sean said, "but people think it is." The realtor's face flashed into his mind, blanching when he'd asked about the pets, dying to sell the property, if you'll forgive the pun. "How long has that place been for sale?" he wondered. Dean pulled a spiral-bound notebook out of his jacket pocket and flipped through it.
"Wow," he said. 4 years. Hard sell."
"That house was adorable, and a great price," Gus said. Then his eyes widened and he turned to Sean. Sean was already starting to bounce.
"I know," Sean squealed, and they bounced around the room exuberantly, ending with a delicious belly bump.
When they finished, the agents were staring at them, confounded.
"What?" Sean asked. "Don't you guys do that when you solve a case?"
Sam and Dean returned to Awesome State when they picked the lock on the house in, like, seconds. Sean didn't trust it anymore, though. He knew they'd revert to dickishness at any moment.
"Mr. Spencer? Mr. Baldwin?" a nervous voice called from the foyer.
"In here," Sean called from the living room. Sophie appeared in the room.
"How'd you get in?" she asked.
Sam and Dean entered the room behind her.
"We have ways," Dean said.
"Agents," Sophie said, and put a startled hand to her throat.
"I thought you said everything was okay here. Or did you want to look at the house with your friends?"
She looked so desperately hopeful that Sean felt bad for her.
"Sophie, Sophie, Sophie," he said. "And I thought we'd finally found somewhere that Gus and I could settle down with our little baby Shih Tzu, Mr. Miyagi."
"If you don't think the house is right, why did you call me?" Sophie asked. She was trembling and white.
Sam strode to the middle of the room, carrying a blacklight. He turned it on over the beautiful hardwood floor, and it illuminated a circle filled with complicated symbols.
Sophie screamed.
"Wow," Sean said. "I mean, the hardwood is beautiful,
beside him, Gus was nodding.
But I mean, you put that there, right?
Sophie put her hands to her mouth.
How could you know? She wailed.
Oh, I'm a psychic, Sean said. Didn't my friends tell you?
Really?
Sophie squeaked, then burst into tears. Fortunately, there was enough staging in the house to get Sophie a chair, and Gus had tissues. Sean found a chair and sat beside her and patted her knee. She really was cute, even if she was raising the dead.
I didn't mean to, Sophie sniffed once she had calmed a little. It's just this stupid house, and my boss won't take me off it, and she's all over me, all the time, to get it sold. But there's this stupid story about it being haunted, and it's not, really. I've spent so much time in here, and there's nothing.
Sophie dabbed at her eyes. Then this couple came who wanted to look at the house because they thought it was haunted, she continued. And of course, it's not, so they wouldn't buy. Told me to give them a call if I came across a genuine haunted house for sale. They thought it would be a good conversation piece or something, to live in a haunted house.
So you decided to make it haunted, Sam said, and Sophie nodded. She picked up her folder and flipped through the pages until she found the one she wanted and handed it out to Sam.
I found it on the internet, she said. It said it would raise the dead, but I thought it meant it would bring a ghost to the house. Not, you know.
Raise the dead? Dean asked dryly.
Yeah, Sophie said, and burst into tears again. And I couldn't find anything on the internet to reverse it. There was this ghost chasers or something. They talked about how to get rid of ghosts, but everything about zombies just said to remove the head or destroy the brain. But I don't know how to do that, and anyway... Ew!
Sean put an arm around Sophie and let her put her head on his shoulder.
Sam held up the paper Sophie had given him.
We'll take care of this, he said, and Dean nodded in agreement.
Just careful on the internet from now on, okay, Sophie?
Gus pulled up in front of the Mermaid Inn, and he and Sean got out.
So the CDC agents took care of it, right? Gus asked.
No more living dead in Santa Barbara?
I think there's a serious possibility that they're not really CDC agents, Sean said. Then added, that's what Sam said on the phone. I just thought we should stop and check, tell them thanks.
He started to rap on the motel room door, but it swung inward. Sophie came out. She was wearing the same clothes she'd had on the day before, and she looked like she was feeling a lot better.
Oh, Mr. Spencer, Mr. Baldwin, she said. I can't thank you enough for everything. You've both been so kind, especially you, Mr. Spencer.
She self-consciously fussed with her mussed hair. And I would be so happy to show you some more places. In fact, I'll forego my commission when you buy. I know that the perfect home is out there for you two and your little Mr. Miyagi.
She stood on her toes to kiss Sean's cheek and then beamed happily at them before getting in her car and driving away. Sean and Gus turned to watch her go.
When they turned back around, Dean was leaning in the doorway, looking like the cat that ate the canary.
Boys, he said, then yelled, Sammy!
Inside the Impala, parked beside Gus's car, Sam shot up in the back seat, bleary-eyed and hair sticking up everywhere.
I'm up, Sam said groggily.
Dean shut the motel room door and tossed a duffel in the back while Sam climbed into the passenger seat.
Good luck with your psychic stuff, Dean said with a grin as he got behind the wheel.
Good luck with your ghost facing, Gus said, because he always had Sean's back. Sean gave him a little fist bump.
Dean's grin faded, but beside him, Sam started laughing. Dean slammed the car into gear, spun around, and pulled out onto the highway.
When you can't.
1985. Henry sipped his beer. "Zombies," he said again, still in disbelief. "Yep," Winchester said, not looking away from the game on the overhead TV. "No wonder I couldn't solve the stupid case," Henry mused. "Yep," Winchester said again. Henry waited for another round. "What's the score?" he asked. This is Baylor, and you've been listening to Changing Channels, an anthology of supernatural crossover fic. These and other stories are available online at baylorsr.livejournal.com. Thanks for listening.